Track 8, Normal for Norfolk. We have received a spooky recording from our friend Trevor Freeborn at Waveney Words, which is the talking newspaper for Diss and the Waveney Valley. Brace yourselves as Basil Abbott, manager of Diss Museum, tells the tale of a ghost walk around the market town he organised recently.
There are parts of the town that have a numinous quality, an atmosphere. The name may have come from Dispater, the Roman god of the underworld, so the mere may be the entrance to the infernal regions. Mere Street was originally called Thames Street. The river running through London is called the Thames. Elsewhere there is the Tamar, the Tame, and many other waterways with words beginning with Tem or Tam. This may come from the Celtic words for dark waters, so Thames Street may have been the street down to the dark waters. The centre of Diss is full of ghosts, as I've found out through talking to local people. The first three premises I visited are next to each other in the marketplace and were once townhouses. At the travel agents, a girl said that she was entering the loo once and had her hand on the door handle when the door was violently opened inwards, although there was nobody there. Next door at Boots, Angela said that a girl had heard a sound like the rustle of crinoline along a passage. Several had heard noises like someone sweeping when there was nobody there. At Beale's, Yvonne said she'd seen a shadow when there was nobody there and had heard distinct noises. Stock that had been carefully placed had been violently disturbed and a glass table had shattered overnight. One girl who said she had psychic feelings had seen and talked to a figure in green velvet and a lace collar. His name was Robert. I pointed out that the last man to be publicly hanged here was Robert Carlton, a tailor who would have had his premises in the middle of town. Across the street was the old King's Head Hotel, which had a grey lady ghost, and may well have been where the victims of mere drownings were laid out, there being half a dozen of these in the Haywood Road Cemetery. At what was until recently Johnson's the Cleaners, previously Chenery's and other businesses over the years, there was a ghost called George. Workmen often found things had been moved and were unwilling to go upstairs. A girl felt something brush past her at the top of the stairs and she went cold. A pincushion disappeared and its owner asked George to return it. When she came back, the pincushion was back in its normal place. The building has two cellars and a rumoured tunnel to the old King's Head building. The hairdressers at the Dolphin House said there was the ghost of a small boy and a woman in long boots and skirt. Staff had been asked to see to a customer, only to find that there was nobody there. Things have often been moved. At 1 Church Street, the house by the churchyard, there had been unexplained noises and footsteps next to where the Guildhall School used to be. Diss Museum's ghost walk took people through the churchyard to meet characters from the town's past. First was John Skelton, Tudor poet laureate and rector of Diss. He once found a neighbouring clergyman hawking in the church and made it into a poem called Where the Hawk. I shall you make relation by way of apostrophation under supportation of your patient toleration, how I, Skelton, laureate, devised and also rate upon a lewd curate, a parson benefised, but nothing well advised. He shall be as now nameless, but he shall not be blameless, nor he shall not be shameless, for sure he wrought amiss to hawk in my church of Diss. In 1861, Mr. and Mrs. Ringer of Walcott Green near Diss left their house in charge of a servant named Susan Garrod, and on their return in the evening found her suffering from several gunshot wounds in the head and face, inflicted by a man named Charles Sheldrake, a returned convict employed as a groom and gardener by Mr. Ringer. Sheldrake, after committing the deed, secreted himself in a wood. On being called on by the police to surrender, he placed the muzzle of a double-barrelled gun to his mouth and blew out his brains. At the inquest, the jury returned a verdict of felo de se, and the coroner gave a warrant for the interment of the body between the hours of 9 and 12 o'clock. The body was accordingly buried at 10 o'clock at night under one of the paths in the churchyard. In 1213, Matilda Fitzwalter, daughter of the Lord of the Manor, was said to have been poisoned by King John for rejecting his advances. Not a very likely story. Near Diss there dwelt a brave and noble man. I will tell you of him if indeed I can. He led the barons against King John and made him sign Magna Carta later on. Sir Robert Fitzwalter, the Valiant by name, known for knightly bearing and battle fame. He had a daughter, so all men do say, and she was fair, as is the rose in May. This wench Matilda was now well grown, and men desired to have her for their own, with buttocks broad and breasts round and high, and right fair was her hair, I will not lie. But all so far had given up the search, for she loved only God and holy church. Then came one day the lustful, godless king, and heard this maid as she did pray and sing. He saw her and forgot his wretched life, and knew that he must have her for his wife. To see her bathing was his heart full sore, but she would show him nothing but the door. He wept, he raved, he smote the palace wall, and none who stood around could help at all. To Mary Mild he prayed, save me from death, but Mary looked away and saved her breath. By jealous thoughts his plaguey heart was taunted, as she spurned his gross attentions, nothing daunted. I'd make an ardent lover, take your pick, said she, you'd make an ardent lover sick. At length the monarch's ardour turned to hate, and he sent an envoy to her father's gate, saying, rid me of this scurvy maid, whose heart she'd never let be swayed, even by her king so brave, so let her languish in the grave. A poisoned egg was served to her on toast, and fair Matilda then gave up the ghost. In 1742 we had our last public hanging, attended by thousands of people. Robert Carlton went for the long drop on Discommon, for poisoning Mary Frost, and for the then crime of sodomy. He admitted the latter while denying the killing. In 1827 there was the murder in the Red Barn at Polstead in Suffolk, spawning a century of melodramas. In 1829 we had our own barn murder, if some of the accounts are to be believed. Louis Bryant, a woman in her late 40s, was said to have been at a dance in what is now Croft Lane, when someone came in and whispered a message to her. She went off out into the darkness, never to be seen alive again. Her body with 40 stab wounds was found the next day in what is now Louise Lane, named after her. The murder weapon was found, many were questioned, but her death remains a mystery. In 1910, Dr. Crebbin was hanged for poisoning his wife and burying her mutilated remains in the cellar before fleeing across the Atlantic with his mistress Ethel Leneve. Most people have heard of Crebbin, but few people know that Ethel came from Diss. She was charged as an accessory after the fact, but was acquitted. Her counsel, F.E. Smith, Lord Birkenhead, said that he felt she was innocent in every sense of the word. But author David James Smith, author of Supper with the Crippens, said she was in it right up to her eyebrows. The Mannings, four of them, were rectors from the time of the American War of Independence to the First World War. Much of the church restoration in Victorian times was under the guidance of Charles Robertson Manning. His uncle was Himalayan traveller Thomas Manning, the first European to reach Lhasa and meet the boy Dalai Lama. The ghost walk continued up the alley called Draper's Row, where we met John Betjeman and Mary Wilson. So John came here in 1963 and made a film called Something About Diss. He walked up the alley and noted the overhanging medieval beams at the top. Buildings were made like that because they were taxed on the amount of ground they covered, so having the upper rooms bigger than the lower made sense. He came back in 1969 with Lady Wilson. They both wrote a poem about their day. On the ghost walk, they delivered spoof versions of the poems, suggesting that the day may not have been a success. Dear John, I'm here against my wishes, with Harold at home doing the dishes. If we're seen going for a walk, it might look strange and people might talk. They'd say, look at him, he's making passes, when we were just bending over the brasses. It doesn't look right in your position with the wife of the leader of the opposition. They'll think we're up to naughty capers and we'll end up in the Sunday papers. They'll say, I'm a floozy and you're a bounder, and this is a scene from Brief Encounter. There's one thing I've dreaded since I was a girl, and that's ending up in the News of the World. With these dark glasses and your broad span, they'll say Garbo is meeting the Michelin man. You don't know how awful all this would appear, and it would ruin poor Harold's career. You stay here and compose an ode while I walk down to dear old Friends Road. They will meet in Wren's at 3:15, but at separate tables for scones and tea. Then we'll walk to the station with you at the rear. I just pray that nobody recognises us here. We'll go back as if all this had never occurred. I'll go first class and you can go third. And we'll hope against hope that the press will all miss that unfortunate day that we both came to Diss. Dear Mary, I thought it would be bliss to go with you by train to Diss, not knowing what was round the bend as we chugged through the old East End. Then, as the train became more pacey, through Essex, land of Sharon and Tracy. The fields then became more flat as I looked out, holding on to my hat. There are big pearly skies and plovers in flight, and postmen asking if you've got a light. With Air Force bases of Phantom and Harrier that make East Anglia an American carrier. This could have been a day of pleasures as we looked round the old church treasures. But Mary can be an awkward filly, a nice enough woman, but bloody silly. I didn't think she'd be quite so contrary, so come, friendly bombs, and fall on Mary. Up Market Hill at Albright's, Gloria said that coloured things had been disturbed in the night, as though children had been fascinated by them and played with them. Standing outside the Tudor house by the 14th century corner post, featuring the Annunciation and Nativity, you feel again a numinous quality with history in every direction. Weaver's restaurant is on the site of the St. Nicholas Chapel, which had a graveyard where Gazer's is and a guild hall in the Tudor house. The guild was a kind of medieval assurance company. You paid, say, a penny a week to partake of their largesse and for them to pray for your soul after death, an important point in Catholic medieval England. After the Reformation, such Catholic practices declined, as did the chapel. But a historian has noted that the porch of the Greyhound may have come from the chapel, as did the west wall, the pub having been built at about the same time, about 1580. It has supposed connections with King James and his mistresses, or maybe male partners, plus spooky noises and footsteps. At the Cornhall, someone said there was a figure sometimes seen in the doorway between the bar and the main hall. The building was based on two real Greek temples. In the late 18th century, two Englishmen went to Greece and documented everything about the old buildings. From this, they published six volumes entitled Antiquities of Athens. This led to the Greek Revival and is the reason we have pillared buildings all over the world. It became fashionable. If you were designing a building, you could look through these volumes and say, oh, I like that one. We'll base our corn exchange on that. Both those that inspired Discornhall are long gone, one destroyed by an earthquake and the other fell down and was dismantled. But their influence is clearly seen, complete with the atmosphere of a temple. It has no windows because Greek temples didn't have them. This helped create a numinous feeling. Dim lighting and a statue of a goddess would create an awesome experience. The old Two Brewers pub next door had a connection with a mere drowning. In 1877, Fanny Nunn, daughter of the landlady, lost her life there, at a time when the mere was fenced, so she either wanted to end her own life or someone ended it for her. Her boyfriend, Alfred Wiley, was suspected and accused in the local press. He offered himself as a witness, but was never tried. The verdict was murder by person or persons unknown, but suicide was suspected. On to Beehive Yard, where Thomas Paine worked as a staymaker in the 1760s. He would go on to write the three best-selling works of the 18th century, Common Sense, Rights of Man, and The Age of Reason, and would be a prominent figure in both the American and French revolutions. The ghost walk ended with a glow stick lit procession back down to the museum for refreshments. Next time you're walking through Dis, that figure you see at an upper window might not be a hairdresser or a boots girl having a break.
Thank you, Basil, and thanks to Trevor for sharing the recording. I hope that wasn't too scary for you. The ghost walk was supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. I was actually involved in that ghost walk, playing Canon Manning, standing in the grounds of the church at the top of Mere Street. From all accounts of the walk, I was rubbish. Basil, however, does put on a good show.